Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexities of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you have any comments you would like to make during this broadcast or in the future, any questions you have, feel free to email me at bonkay@aol.com. That's bonkaye@aol.com. Before I introduce my special guest tonight, I just want to mention that, wow, in just 2 months, we have the Healing Weekend coming up, 2 months from this weekend, and I am really psyched out. I'm so excited. Another 8 weeks from now, I'll be converging in California with some of the most wonderful women that I've had the opportunity to know. Some of them are wonderful women who have been there on numerous different times to try to share their healing with others. And it's just a beautiful event in Irvine, California. If you're interested in coming, there's only a few seats left, you know, because we can only take so many people to have an effective weekend. But there's still time, so if you're interested, please write to me at bonkay@aol.com. Or go to my website at gayhusbands.com, and there you'll see a link to information for the Healing Weekend. Once again, it's going to be an amazing event, our best one ever in beautiful California. So tonight I'd like to introduce a guest who normally I say they're wonderful guests, one terrific guest. This guest, I have to say, is a beautiful guest. And I don't say she's just beautiful because physically she is beautiful, and she is. But she's beautiful inside and outside, which is a rarity in today's world, that her beauty inside is bigger than her beauty outside. So that says how beautiful she really is. And someone who I've come to learn to love, respect, and I'm so excited that she's with me tonight. Alexa Servadidio, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you so much for having me back on. It's my pleasure, and I just love being on your show, and thank you for all such the kind words.
Well, it's really the truth. They're not kind words, because you are a rarity in the world today, because it's a crazy world we're living in. It's a different world than the world I grew up in, where people were allowed to talk and they were allowed to have different opinions without being shouted down and being, you know, doomed because they thought differently than other people. And I think it's a world that I'm just not really ready for, where people are just very, I think, very cruel in a lot of ways to people, that I didn't see this in the past growing up. Have you noticed a change in the way society is going in that sense?
Yes, unfortunately I have, and it's very, very disturbing. And I find that people aren't allowed to have their own opinion, number one, and number two, if they express their own opinion, literally they're not safe from emotional abuse, physical abuse. It's gotten to a point where people can't tolerate someone having an opposite view, and it's a very frightening time.
I agree with you. I really feel that for the first time in my many, many years, because I am older, but I've never seen the chaos of a generation like this. And I saw a lot. I saw a lot of times when a country was divided and really needed healing, like in the 1960s and 70s with the Vietnam War. There was a tremendous divide then between the old and the young, the establishment, the non-establishment. There was a lack of communication, a lack of understanding. I grew up in those days, so I was very well aware of it. But it was different than today. Today, it's almost as if there's just such a breakdown in communication, and people judge you by the way you think, where before people were allowed to express their different, you know, kind of opinions. And so you had a different opinion that didn't stop you from being friends with someone, or it didn't create people bullying you, or it didn't make you a leper in the town because nobody, you know, wanted to talk to you because you disagreed with them. You just agreed that people had different opinions and you could still be friends. Today, I think the whole environment is just very discouraging as far as, you know, people's behavior. And I just don't know, is there such a thing as healing from this? You're a therapist. Let's hear what you have to say.
I believe so. But I also find that both sides, people really have to start being aware of the impact of their actions and of their words, because I think that's where it needs to begin. I mean, yes, it's hard, you know, a lot, there's one, people can't tolerate people having different views, but two, if they're ruining that person's reputation or having them lose their job or accusing them of horrific things. So I think it's number one for people to make sure you're not just throwing around words and names and accusations just because someone doesn't agree with you. And I think, two, it's really being able to say, you know, you don't have to say everything that's on your mind. You don't have to always attack somebody or defend your own views. You should be able just to say what you feel and not always have to defend yourself. So I believe on both sides, people really have to come together and say it's okay to have other people have other views. People are still good people, and I think really looking at the person underneath for who they are and not just be blinded by whatever glasses you're wearing or your view or your perception of a certain type of person is, and not be able to have that happen, so then you cannot have any type of relationship or even have any empathy towards the others. We're all human beings. We should be able to have empathy towards each other.
And that's what I really felt was going on in this country for a long time. People did have different opinions, different views, different politics. There's always been different sides and people who agreed and disagreed. But I always felt there was some common bond of humanity where people could drop whatever their barriers were to having a relationship with someone, to talk out something, to come up with a solution. What it seems today, so I don't know if it's a majority, but it's a very vocal minority group of people who really don't want to, you know, give in or compromise or listen. And I think this is a problem of society today. And even in our roles as straight wives, for the women who listen to this show, you know, this is a problem because people judge us, and maybe this will make some sense to you. that when we've been in a relationship with a gay man who has deceived us in our marriage and taken away a lot of who we are as women, that when we have complaints about this, right away the gay community, portions of the gay community, certainly not all of them, they like to view us as being homophobic when it has nothing to do with homophobia. Most of the women who were part of this support network were the most pro-gay women that you could ever imagine, you know, as far as being advocates for their friends and for the gay community, which is a totally different situation than when you find out that your husband is gay. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, those that feel that they need to, that attack women who are going through these different events in their life, to realize, are they speaking from their own pain? Because sometimes, you know, I work with a lot of people that are victims of abuse, and sometimes the reason why they hate one group of person or this person in general is because they represent, in their mind, they perceive them as, this is what happened to me. This is what this person is the type of person that would do this to me. Instead of looking at each person as an individual, we have to make sure we have our own trauma, and we need to be able to honor our trauma and be able to acknowledge it and speak about it, of course, and not deny it. But make sure you're not judging or comparing your trauma to somebody else's. And I think to be able to hear these women of what they're going through, but just to hear them as a person that's been suffering, not as that this person now is threatening what your reality is. I think people need to make sure that they're not always blinded by that.
Mm-hmm. Alexa, a lot of the times the problems, some of the statements that we hear from the outside community, and maybe you can talk a little bit about this. When you're going through this suffering, I always say there's no time limit on healing, that everybody has to grieve in his or her own, you know, timeline. This particular kind of marriage seems to take longer than other marriages, only because it's not just like a marriage where two people didn't get together and so life went on and they went their separate ways and they get a divorce. But this is literally living somebody else's lie with them as they strip away who you are as a person so that they don't have to take responsibility for the problems in the marriage. They turn and they blame almost everything on you. And they take away, they strip your sense of reality. Of course, for every woman, I always feel there's a great sense of, you know, dignity that you lose when you're rejected sexually. Sex is an important part of who a woman is, a part of your feminine spirit. And when you're being told that sexually that you're inadequate or that your body smells or that other women don't smell like this, it's degrading kinds of talk to discourage you from wanting to have sex. That you just, when you're rejected enough, like a woman wrote to me yesterday, she said, I just stopped asking. After enough rejection, I couldn't bear to ask anymore because I knew that I was going to be knocked down. When I hear these letters, and they just make me really cry, because I think about how many years women go through suffering thinking there's something wrong with them when they're living somebody else's lie. And in that sense, I think it takes longer for us to heal because we have to dig through so much emotional garbage that, you know, been saddled on us. And when people say, why don't you just get over it, which they do, how do you respond to something like that?
And unfortunately, I hear that all the time from my clients is, you know, people to say, why don't you just move over, you know, move on, get over it. If it was that easy, believe me, people would be doing it. No one wants to be suffering like this. It's not that easy. And number one, the grieving process from an end of a marriage, mm-hmm. a divorce, in its own, is its own grieving process. And there is no time limit. And the stages of grief can go in different sequences, and it's not the same for each person. Some can be longer. Some can go back and forth. You can't have, okay, 6 weeks, you're going to start to feel better. So you have to dissect that, work through that. Then you have to work through the fraud of the marriage, that this person wasn't just that, okay, the marriage didn't work out, they don't want to be with me anymore. It's they weren't who I thought they were. This is someone I love. This is someone I trusted. This is someone I had children with. This is someone I shared my most intimate life with. We promised to be with each other forever. And then realize you ended up marrying someone who wasn't who they were. I think that is a total violation, and that's a whole different layer for anyone to have to work through. And a lot of times people will blame themselves. Why didn't I know? How could I not know? Well, how did this all happen? Is this really true? Maybe it's just me. And I think it's so many different layers that women really need the chance to be able to go through each grieving process, but then for each different layer of what they're going through.
And I think that people just don't understand this, because I think in other divorces, and not all the time, but the majority of people, they go on, they meet other people. There wasn't such a sense of self-doubt that you made a mistake. I mean, this is a major decision. Some women live in these situations 20, 30, 40 years. I mean, I'm working with a woman now in her 70s who just joined our support network, who was married for so many years. And, you know, she learned at a very late age that her husband is gay. And she thought back to all the times how abusive he was and how rejected she felt and how she felt that she had nothing left and her feminine spirit was gone. She didn't have sex for 25 years, you know, which is an important part of intimacy in building a relationship. And she had no clue until a couple of years ago. And when she found out, she was so devastated, because you live your life with a lie that somebody else is having you live with him. And this is what I say to these men who are gay men. I said, you really need to be honest and tell your wives the truth. I just can't imagine, you know, it's bad enough living a lie every day of your life as these guys do. And I understand these men are not trying to trick you when they get married to you. They really are hoping that they're not going to be gay. They're hoping that if they love you enough, those nagging feelings and those urges will go away. But when they don't work, rather than throwing it out on your partner and making her life miserable, you know, it's time for you to fess up and just tell the truth. You marry somebody and you claim to love them. Well, this is not what love is about. And maybe you could talk a little bit, Alexa, about you work with couples and dysfunctional families. I mean, what is a loving relationship supposed to be like?
A loving relationship is supposed to be one of respect. It's definitely, you know, nothing's perfect, but there's a common bond of respect and also a trust. And you feel that you can say you have good intentions for the other person and that person has those intentions for you, no matter what, you know, has gone on, if there's been infidelity or there's a gambling problem or something like that, and that both parties are coming to the table to say, I love you, it's going to be hard, but let's work through this. But there has to be honesty. I tell the couples that come in, we've got to put everything on the table. The good, bad, and the ugly. There's going to be some things that are going to be really hard for you to tell your spouse that you've done or that you've thought, but we don't want any more surprises coming up. And we need to be very honest so then you two can heal through this. So I think there has to be accountability on both sides. So when someone is not feeling good about themselves or is warring with themselves who they are, who their sexuality is, and they're taking it out on their spouse, the spouse, most of the time, I don't think really knows what's going on. They think something's wrong with me. Maybe I need to lose weight. Maybe I need to dress better. Maybe, you know, I'm not that great. And I think then also when the intimacy and the sex are cut off, that's a whole different layer, because the couple needs that. They need to have that time together of that bonding and that reinforcement that they're one, that they're a unit. And I find so many times when the sex is cut off and there's no reason for it, there's no explanation, or if there's blame, I'm just not attracted to you, you know, you smell and you're not, you know, you repulse me, that on a whole different layer is so offensive. So I find that couples really need to be honest with each other, but also be able to empathize and want the best for each other.
Alexa, let me ask you this question so you can reinforce this, because I think that we really stand the same on this. When you have a family unit, and so many times women say to me, I'm staying here because of the children. I'm staying here because it's important for them to have family security. I say that when you have children growing up in a toxic environment where there's no love, there's just contempt and there's disrespect, there's no affection, there's no loving, there's fighting. And women say to me, well, they don't know we're fighting. We fight late at night after they're asleep. They're really deluding themselves. Children always know when you're fighting. But I think a lot of times women think they're forced to stay in the situation because it's for the children. Now, my personal opinion is that if it's really for the children, then you have to do what's best for the children. That's not stay in a toxic situation. Because even Dr. Phil says it's better to come from a broken home than to be in a broken home. And I came from a broken home, and I was broken as a result of that. It took me many, many, many years to rebuild my life because my family was really broken. Do you feel that there's any advantage to staying in a family that's broken?
If the family is not actively getting help and they're not openly spoken about what's going on, I find it's very damaging. And I think what it does consciously, starts teaching the children, to tolerate behaviors, to tolerate neglect, to tolerate maybe people being cold, people not showing emotion or very intense emotional experiences. And the more a child, even though if the parents believe they don't see it, they don't hear it, kids sense everything. They know. They just have this, and they always blame themselves. They start to, after a while, it becomes the new normal. As a woman or a man who's in a physically abusive relationship, after a while, they start saying, oh, he didn't hit me this hard this time, or it's, you know, it's not this bad, or he had a really bad day, I shouldn't have done. People start, defending or justifying, and I think it's very hard because even though the best of parents will tell their children, this is not how you should be spoken to, don't worry about it, that's your loved one, that's your parent. You love them. You don't ever want to see any of them being hurt. But when you see them hurting each other, I find a lot of times those children grow up and end up being in relationships to reenact, to have a better outcome. And what ends up happening, they get stuck in a relationship where they're tolerating a lot of bad behaviors that they should not be tolerating.
Yeah, I call it my monkey see, monkey do, monkey act, just like you syndrome. That wherever the children see in their own household is going to affect their future relationships. So, for instance, with domestic violence, because I know you work with domestic violence, and in fact, you have a whole chapter on this in your book, Finding Your Peace Within the Chaos. When you talk about domestic violence, I've worked with women who have been in situations of domestic violence, and their children, grow up in that situation. And then when they get married, it's like a legacy you leave behind. They very often find someone just like, they're just like you, and they find somebody in the same situation, and they have repeated domestic violence in their own relationship because they think that, you stay with it because my mom stayed with it and because it must not be too bad because she stayed all that time. Like, you just keep repeating this pattern over and over. Do you find that to be true?
Yes.
In any kind of abuse?
Yes, and I find sometimes they might even be out. The person will say, I would never put up with this. I would never do that. I'm going to make sure. And they really try not to find someone who's abusive emotionally or physically. But I find a lot it's people who are abusers, who are perpetrators, they know how to find people. They can fish around, and they can find people who've come from broken homes or who will tolerate things that other people wouldn't tolerate. And it's almost like, and then they groom their victims. So I find, these the people that are children that are growing up, they're almost, even if with the best of intentions, they just have to really be careful because they've been it's almost like their immune system, they become immune to it. So they have to make sure they're really aware what is acceptable and what is not.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. How do you break the cycles of dysfunction in families? I mean, what do you tell people they need to do?
One, they have to acknowledge that there's a problem and be aware of it. And two, get into therapy. I find that's really, really important. Everyone can't do everything on their own. So I find the way of breaking that cycle of dysfunction is also naming the dysfunction. What is it? How did it begin? And I think really saying, what in my life now is there any toxic people or any of that dysfunction in my life, and what have I taken ahead moving forward? But I also think if every family member is not on board and getting help, there has to be some distancing. Because a lot of times people will still say, you know, I just still got to be running, and the person is still very abusive. And they say, I just want to listen this time. People are human. When someone is screaming at you and telling you you're no good on a daily basis, no matter how strong you are and how, you know, great sense of self you have, that hurts. We're human. That eats away at us. That gnaws at our way as our person, our self-esteem, and who we are. So I think it's important to say, okay, will the dysfunctional family, will people be active in treatment? And two, if they're not, then what are the very strict boundaries that need to be put up?
Mm-hmm. How about if somebody would come to you and they tell you that they want to work on their marriage or their relationship, but their partner doesn't? You know, he refuses. What do you tell them?
Well, if they want to do, obviously, if they want to do couples therapy and he won't come in, or she won't come in, that's obviously can't be the couples therapy. But I do have sometimes couples that will come in and one will say, it's over. I really, you know, I'll come here, but I don't really see anything happening. And the other person saying, I want this to work. Let's try it. And I say, okay, if we both try it, we don't know what the outcome is, but you're both here and let's have the guidelines of moving forward. But if someone wants to work on the marriage and they're coming to see me individually, I will, of course, work with them and set out goals, but I'll also say, okay, what are you wanting to see in 3 months, 6 months, 8 months, to a year? What are deal breakers for you? What is going to be the cutoff point or the, oh, okay, this is moving where I'm going? You have to have some sort of idea, well, this is a deal breaker. If there's a year and he's still having affairs on me and this is really affecting my mental health and my functioning, we have to say, okay, we worked on certain things and he doesn't want to do his part. Either this is who he is and he's not changing or working on himself, or two, then why do you think you deserve to have to be with someone who's not meeting your needs and who is being so disrespectful to you?
Have you worked with any people with sexual addictions?
Yes. I've worked with a few couples where one has a sex addiction. And it's tough work. I mean, I do believe that if both parties are able to work and the party that has the addiction is getting separate treatment on their own, meetings, groups, all of that is very important, that there can be hope for the couple. But like any addiction, it's an everyday thing. You can't slack off. You have to be aware of it, and you have to know what, you know, people, places, things, what are your triggers.
I know that recently I was interviewed by someone, you know, who runs a whole network for sexual addiction, and I said to him, what are the chances of recovery? Because I think they're very slim. And he's a recovering sexual addict, and he said it is very slim. It's something you have to work at every single day. And I think that's very true of any addiction, certainly with drugs, you know, you deal with that all the time, with, you know, any kind of drinking addiction, drugs, gambling, you know, it's not something that just, okay, that was then, this is now, I don't feel the same way anymore. I think in most cases, addicts are always feeling that way, and it's a matter of how you maintain that. Am I right in saying that or no?
Yes,
that
yes.
You don't
and
lose
another
your addiction.
Layer of what I've been seeing with the sex addiction is I think there's so much going around, and it's, yes, I totally understand people have to honor themselves and choose who they want to be sexually, but I think it's almost gotten to the extreme where people, as they say, I have to do me. This makes me feel good. I'm attracted to this person. I want to act on it. Yes, you're allowed to have those feelings, but if you're in a marriage or in a relationship, it's not, okay, I have this urge, I have to act on it. It is, I have a responsibility, end the relationship, and then act on it. If you can't have both, and I think that's where people get confused, why can't I have both? With the sex addiction, you really, you know, of course, with disease and everything else that goes around, you really have to understand not, because there's so, you know, different things about it, it has to be very, very strict.
I have to give women credit who stay in these because I could never do it. My ego is not that strong. I just couldn't live with somebody who I knew was cheating on me and had a sexual addiction. I'm not saying people don't do it. I just know I couldn't do it. You know, I know what my crossing point is. And I always tell women that if you feel you can't do it, don't do it. You know, don't force yourself to stay somewhere where you don't feel comfortable or where you don't belong because people think, you know, feel bad for the guy or they think you should understand or it's an illness. I don't feel that should be imposed on someone. I think if you feel you really want to work at it, that you love that person, and you feel there can be, you know, positive change and you can live with the past, that's one thing. But if you're feeling conflicted every day yourself because it's something you don't want to live with and you can't forget and you're going to worry every time he walks out that door and it's killing you inside, then I don't think that you have to stay in that kind of situation. How do you feel about that?
I agree. If it really is so damaging for you, for your mental health, for your quality of life, to a point where you know this is something that you can't work through. That this sometimes there's things in life where I tell couples, sometimes there's no coming back from it. There's just sometimes the boundary was crossed and there's no coming back from it. And I think people have to be really honest with themselves if they want to try, and then after a while they're like, this is really, like, I'm losing even more sleep, I'm very conflicted. I think they really have to look and say, yes, you love this other person and they have a disease. But in this instance, you have to put yourself first because it's just, it's so damaging. And a lot of times when I'm with couples that have a sexual addiction, a lot of times the person who is the sex addict has a history of sexual abuse. So you start putting the puzzle pieces together. Yes, that might take some of the, okay, now I kind of get it. It's not me that he or she isn't attracted to me. It's there was, when this person was young, obviously a disconnect with what healthy sexual reality is and feelings are to unhealthy. And this person learned at a very young age a very unhealthy sexuality. But two, we have to look at how long is it going to take this person to heal? And three, are you able to work through it, or is it just too much?
Well, I think a lot of times with addictions, it's too much. People say they're going to work through them, but they're so, you know, caught up in their addiction, even though I'm not saying their intention wouldn't be good, and I'm not saying they don't love their wives. I'm just saying that I think it's just so hard for them to give it up. Like anything else, like any other kind of addiction, you know, they try, they may go to a few meetings, but the urge is always there, and they can be, like I call, recovering addicts, like, you know, recovering drug addicts, but then something will throw them off, and they want something enough, they'll go for it, and that's why I feel that if the trust is gone, and it's not within you to be able to live with this, then don't live with it, you know, because there's just so much anybody can live with, and if it hurts that much, then what is the point? I just feel that you're cheating yourself to be living in a relationship where you have to be sad or unhappy or live your life as a detective every time somebody walks out the door and trying to follow him and see what is he doing. I just feel that's so complicated in a marriage or in a relationship. And that's why I tell women, you know, you need to move on. Well, especially with a gay husband, there is no point in a relationship. I mean, a gay man is not supposed to be married to a straight woman. I'm not saying there's not exceptions to every rule, but as a whole, this is not a healthy marriage. I mean, a gay man is attracted to men. He's not attracted to you. And emotionally, he may want to stay with you because, you know, he doesn't want to have to face the gay life or the gay world. But the bottom line is that he's not fulfilling your needs. He's fulfilling his own needs of using you as a cover while he's out there having sexual relationships with men. And it's never going to change. They're not going to change their desire for men. It's always going to be there. And they can promise you it's not going to happen again. But that's not the case. They can't help themselves. They are gay men. And it's really hard to find men who can abstain from sex altogether. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I know I've met two who I'm pretty sure have abstained. But as a rule, that's 2 out of 1,000,000. You know, the chances and the odds are not good. So to stay in a situation that can never come of any kind of positivity as far as you feel as a woman, unless you're just looking for a roommate. I mean, there are those women who are just happy. They have a roommate, you know, they can live with it. But I don't think the vast majority of the women I'm working with for sure have any intention of having to live like that. But people do live like that. They make all kinds of compromises. Have you found that too?
Yes, yes. And they have that hope that one day the person will realize that they're better, that they won't be, you know. And I think that's where women get into trouble, is they're still holding themselves responsible, or that they have any power or control over what's going on, or the man has any power or control. If a man is attracted to other men, he can't control it. That it's not, you know, oh, you know, I like chocolate chip cookies, I eat too much, I shouldn't eat them. This is who he's attracted to. His body reacts to other men. And I think no matter how pretty you are, how in shape you get, or how much you love each other and children you have to be realistic. He is sexually attracted to men. That's what he likes. Yes, he has been intimate with you, but he is attracted to men. And you, no matter you, it's not anything wrong with you. It's not a competition.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's not a competition because you're a woman, so you're not going to be competing in that arena. He's attracted to men. That's who he wants to be in bed with. That's who he wants his sexual experience to be with. I think the problem is that some of these men, they're what I call the limbo men. They're caught in between two worlds. They're emotionally straight but sexually gay, and they do not want to identify as gay, at least for many years into their marriage. You know, they would be... I feel horrified if somebody say, oh, you're gay. And in their own minds, they do not believe they're gay, even though they're out there having gay sex. They say, well, that doesn't make me gay. I have a wife. I have sex with my wife. I have children. I have a family. Don't accuse me of being gay. I'm not one of those guys. Just because I have some sexual encounters with men doesn't make me gay. Have you dealt with men like that?
Yes, yes. And I've also dealt with men who have frequented transgender women who are born male but are female now, and as long they will say, no, I'm not gay, it is a transgender, she's transgender, and really believe that it's not another man. And I think it's really being honest with what's going on. And I think I happened to see the film Bohemian Rhapsody with Freddie Mercury, and it starts off, he's in a relationship with a woman, and as everyone knows his story, he does turn out to be gay. And it really shows, I mean, you really see the love relationship of him and his girlfriend, his fiance, of how it goes. And you say he loved her at one point. He does love her as a person, but he cannot control those urges of other being with men.
Now, I talked to my nephew, who is transgender. He's now not my nephew any longer. And I said to him, I had this conversation. I said to him, what kind of men do you go with? Do you go with gay men? And he said to me, oh, no. He said, gay men have no interest in me whatsoever because a gay man is not looking for someone who looks like a woman. So I said, so what kind of men do you go with? He said, I go with straight men. So I said to him, you know, this is where you have to understand, you know, he's young. He's in his mid-20s. And I said to him, they're not straight men. I said, if they were straight men, they would be looking for women who have vaginas, not women who have penises. I said, to me, the penis is always the dividing line, that once you cross over it, you're then having gay sex. And you can justify it in any way you want. You can say she has breasts, you can dress it up, you can make it look like a woman, but it's still a man. So you cannot tell me that those people are straight. So I said to him, don't tell me they're straight. There has to be something else. So he said there's a term within the community called trans-attracted. So I guess that's what they are, but you can't convince me that these men are straight. A straight man would find that totally, you know, totally abhorrent. They would never go for that. Do you agree?
Yes, yes, I agree. And I've heard a lot of even more confusing where a lot of straight men will say when with a transgender, as long as I don't perform anything on the on the transgender, they perform on me, that does not make me gay because I didn't actually do anything. It was done to me. And it's almost, you know, when you hear people speak about those things, you can, it's just the denial that comes up. It's being, no, that's still sexual activity. It's still,
mm-hmm.
you know, I believe it's, you know, why then not just go with a woman?
With a
so
woman.
I think that's
right.
what the difference is. Even if a transgender looks exactly like a woman and she's beautiful, and I believe there are cases out there where men didn't know it was a transgender and fell in love with this person sooner or later and found out and ended up staying. I get that. That's a different story. But I think to keep on doing that and then keep saying, I'm not gay, I'm a married man, or I'm straight, it's a little, there needs to be some more work done with that.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a way of justifying, who, you know, to make you feel better about yourself that you're not gay. And I guess one thing I'll always question, as all of my women question, how is it that some men can who are gay men deal with this from the time they're babies or little children? They know they're gay. They grow up. They're not looking for a woman. They're looking for another man. And I tell women that, you know, you can't beat yourself up because you never knew this, because I'm telling you now, I know it's a fact, that when I was growing up, I certainly didn't understand any of this. I thought that gay people were people who were attracted to the same sex. No one ever told me that a gay person gets married to a woman. The whole point of gay was to understand there is the same sexual attraction. So when we meet our husbands and they're attracted to us and they want to marry us and they sleep with us, they have children with us, why would we as women think they were gay? I mean, it just doesn't register to us. And even though other people say, oh, you didn't know, I always knew. Well, maybe they did, and maybe we didn't. I mean, maybe we just couldn't conceive that a gay man would want to marry us. We didn't understand the situation. There was really, when I was going through all this back in the 80s, there was no help out there. Nobody was talking about it until I started talking about it. You know, there was very little talk or very little resources for help or very few people who knew anything about it. So I always tell our women, you can't be hard on yourself, even in today's age. Why would women think that a gay man wanted to marry her? But I do tell her there's a lot you can look for, you know, that you have to recognize red flags. And the problem that I think you can understand is when women come out of these marriages, they're really damaged. And if they look too soon to meet somebody else to make up for all their lost time, they're going to be just as lost with somebody else who may not be gay, but who has some other kind of behavior dysfunction or some other kind of personality disorder. And as you were saying early in the broadcast, these guys know how to find you. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. Guys who have personality disorders, how they look and they hone in on women who are vulnerable.
Yes. Well, they do a lot of fishing, what I call, is they practice. They throw things out there to see what you will put up with and what you won't put up with. It might be start off with maybe just, you know, I'll call you, and then they never call, which happens a lot in relationships. And then they'll say, okay, uh-huh. she kind of went through that. That's okay. And then maybe the name calling, or then maybe, you know, flirting with somebody else in front of them, and they say, oh, I just had a couple of drinks. Don't worry about it. And if they start to see, and they also it also becomes grooming, because they start making you start thinking there's something wrong with you, or they do gaslighting and make you feel that you're crazy. What are you talking about? You're
uh-huh.
just really insecure. There's something's wrong with you. What's wrong with you? You need help. Well, why don't you stop worrying about me? Worry about yourself. You're crazy. And then the woman starts really looking at herself saying, wow, because she would never think the person that she met, why would another human being do this? And a lot of times when people come into my office for the first time who have been exposed to someone who has a severe personality disorder like this, they are so blinded that I have to spend a lot of the sessions in the beginning explaining to them these people are out there. They're like, why would they exist? People really do this? Like, this is who they are? I said, yes, this is who they are. They have the personality. They have a void. They never had that feeling that we have of remorse or empathy or being able to say, I feel bad. That I really hurt that person. What they'll say is, wow, okay, now I did something that upset this person. Now I'm not getting the $100 this week because I upset them. That's what they see, not, oh, wow, I really hurt this person's feelings. I'm ruining their life. They learn through, okay, well, how does this impact what I get? What is my goal? How do they operate or survive? Is it financial? Is it attention? You know, grandiose thoughts and things like that. People have to really be watchful of that. And I think when you come out of a damaged relationship and you're very vulnerable, those type of people will find you. And not just because it's you. They look for people who are vulnerable, and they'll go through people who aren't vulnerable, but then they'll realize, it's not working. This is going to be too much work. This person is not going to let me do this. And they'll go on to the next person where they can start to grooming and they start to get in a little bit. And if someone's already feeling really bad about themselves and hurt, it's a very easy target.
Yeah, I really find it interesting because I'd really love to know what goes on in the mind of somebody with a personality disorder when he's looking for someone. Like, is he consciously saying, I think she's going to be good for me because I can wrap her around my little finger? I mean, is it a conscious thing? Is it a subconscious, unconscious? Are they aware of what they're doing, do you think?
Some are, yes. I think some are very conscious, and some are that outright manipulative. I want someone to pay all my bills, or I want someone that I can control. And others really believe that they are the center of the universe and that there is no room for anybody else in the room or in this world except for them. And their needs have to be met no matter what. And that might come from they grew up in a dysfunctional family or they had a narcissistic parent where they were never allowed to have their own feelings. So they were never taught that. So then when they meet somebody, they won't allow them to have their feelings. So they become very powerful. So that's how they say, and they say, hey, my mom never allowed me to have my feelings. You can't have your feelings. And that's what they've learned what love is. And that's where they have that void. Some of them are just outright manipulative and want to do that. Others really believe, I believe, that this is what they deserve and their needs need to be met because their needs were never met.
Lexa, when we talk about personality disorders, you know, here are some of the words, of course, that come to mind, narcissism. Sociopathic behavior or antisocial behavior. These are personality disorders that many of us are familiar with. But from your input, do they ever change? Yes or no?
Change, no. Learn how to be a contributing member of society and to be able to have a relationship. They can. But it's not that all of a sudden now we've taught them to have these emotions of remorse. They've been taught that in order to be in a relationship, you have to understand, you don't have to feel it because they can't feel it, but you have to understand when you do this and you cut this person off and don't speak to them for a week out of the blue, this person's not going to be in a relationship with you, and you can't do that. And a lot of times I have clients that go to DBT, dialectical behavior therapy. Well, they will be taught how to know that that's not the right thing to do. So they learn how to mimic other people's feelings and behaviors so they can be a part of society. But they don't get those feelings of, oh, now I feel remorse. Because with most personalities, there's a void. They don't have remorse. It was never there. They can learn what it is, but they don't all of a sudden grow remorseful feelings.
So let me ask you this next question. When you were writing your book, Finding Your Peace Within the Chaos, what did you have in mind when you were writing this book? What was your purpose?
I wanted to be able to share with my readers educational tools, warning signs, information, so they would be able to, especially those who have never been in therapy or don't want to be in therapy or don't understand mental health, get some tools and some education where they'll be able to help themselves and also help others and put it in a way where people could understand it, they could relate to it, because a lot of times a lot of clinical books are different clinical terms and people don't really get it. So I broke it down into scenarios from case studies, from things from my radio show, where people could understand what's going on, so they could say, okay, I get that. That looks familiar. I've been through something like that. So then they're able to know, and also what to look for. A lot of times with, you know, suicide prevention, abuse, so they have some guidelines, so they don't believe they're just navigating through this. Maybe there's something wrong with me. I don't know what this is, but they're able to get some tools and some guidelines to say, okay, this is what depression looks like. This is abuse. This is why. This is my teen who's suicidal, not just having a bad day.
Some of the topics that you bring up in your book are very interesting, especially in today's society, with young people being under such tremendous stress and pressure as far as peer pressure. Not that there always wasn't peer pressure, but it's gone to a new level today. But I think the way people are reacting could be different. So maybe you could explain this also. Like, for instance, in your book, you start off by talking about cutting. And I know that a number of our women have told me that they face this problem with their teenage daughters of cutting. And this is something, to be honest with you, Alexa, I never heard of when I was growing up. Was it going on back then? Is this some kind of new phenomenon?
No, it's been going on for many, 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 many years, unfortunately. It's something that's been going on. And I think a lot of people get confused about it and think, oh, because it's suicide attempts. It's not always suicide. It can end up in suicide. If you try cut so many times, you could end up killing yourself. But it's a lot of times the clients that I work with is to feel pain because they have no feelings at all, or to distract them and have some control of all the chaos that's going on within the world around them. And I found because of this day and age with social media, I don't think anyone has been prepared to the level of how it's gotten, where it's gotten, because we didn't realize, you know, back when I was in school, yeah, bullying is how people would talk about you in class, or they'd send a note to somebody, oh, look at her, she's horrible, or something like that. That was horrific. That bullying was horrific. That's still bullying. Nowadays, they take pictures of you in school, they put you on Facebook, they shame you in front of an audience of worldwide, international audience. So children are not even prepared for it, but adults aren't prepared for the magnitude of what's been going on with the social media.
Do children who cut themselves, is that a sign of depression more so than anything else? Or what is that a sign of?
I always look for sexual abuse history, eating disorder, and now bullying. I find a lot of times cutting, and then I look at their eating habits, and I try to find if there was any type of sexual abuse. I find, unfortunately, they're a trifecta. That there's a lot of that going on. And I think also the depression. There's also obviously depression is after that from whatever they're experiencing. A lot of times with the eating disorders with my clients, I've had 95% of the time there's been sexual abuse. So I find it's really looking at that. And then, of course, the depression from what has happened to them in their lives.
Yeah, I'm really very funny about sexual abuse on children. I really feel people who do this should be shot. I'm just being honest with you. I feel you rob a child of her life or his life, and that's a crime, punishable by death. You know, I just don't understand how so many people can continually get away with this, especially in families, you know, in so many different ways. Even today, you know, you see it's coming from religious leaders more so than ever. You know, people who you trust your children to, you know, who abuse them. You know, I just feel like this is such a life changer. Do children recover from this?
They do. They recover. And what does recovery mean? It's different for each person. I think it always obviously has an impact on their life. But I've had a lot of clients that recover from it. It's a road to go on. And I think it's finding out what does that closure mean. I do a lot of EMDR with clients that have had sexual abuse, eye movement desensitization reprocessing to work through the trauma. And it's really powerful. I've also just started working with, which is unfortunately going on, adolescents that sexually offend on other adolescents. So I work with them on the EMDR to cut down the urges of acting out sexually. So far, so good. It's been working, but I believe it's just there's so many layers to it that it's just frightening. A lot of the clients that I have that are acting out sexually offending have their own sexual abuse history. It's not a justification. It still does no reason why, but I think it's the impacts of it is just horrific.
Yes, there's so many hurt people today that, you know, I think you could work a lifetime and only hit a fingerful full. I mean, it's so sad to see the traumas that children go through. And I'm not saying they didn't always go through them, but we didn't always see it. I think with social media today, we see more things than we ever had to see before. But, I mean, it's certainly good that the secret's out so that children hopefully won't continue to go through this, where in the past they had to be shut up and not talk about it. But it's just very discouraging when you see there's so many sick people out there who are just trying to make nothing out of something that's so horrible. So thank goodness there's you around to try to resolve some of these problems. And let's talk about where you are around. So if people need therapy in the New York area, in Westchester, they can come to you. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. I'm in the Mamaroneck, New York, so you can find me on Psychology Today. The most amazing thing now is a lot of insurances, or if you cannot get to the New York area, are approving telehealth services, which is Skype and phone sessions. So if for some reason you cannot make it to New York or to the Mamaroneck area, check with your insurance companies because they're now approving it and reimbursing for phone sessions and Skype sessions.
And can you tell people your website so they can go see it?
Yes, you can find me just right on Psychology Today, Alexa Servodidio, and you can also, I have an email, Alexa, A-L-E-X-A, S as in Sam, 29 at AOL. So you can definitely find me, send me an email, definitely look on Psychology Today. You can also put my name in and all the work that I do and different populations I work with and insurance and all of that comes right up.
Right, and if you can't find her, just contact me at bondk@AOL and say, how do I get in touch with Alexa? So, Alexa, where can people buy your book, Finding Your Peace Within the Chaos?
Yes, it's on Amazon. Also, if you want an autographed copy, you can contact me again at my email, alexas29@AOL, and I can send you an autographed copy.
That's wonderful. And hopefully your new book will be coming out before
yes,
we know
I'm
it, right?
Yes, I'm working on that now called Your Walk in Life. And what is it based on is my way of treatment, of therapy, my methods. All my clients have thought it's just so different the way I go about treating clients in different situations. So they've asked me to coin it and put it together in a book so everybody else can read it that's not in therapy so they get the same idea of what therapy is like and what the type of work I do.
Okay. Well, to all our listeners out there, I know this is a tough week for many of you because it's Valentine's Day, and I could give you some really uplifting positive messages saying learn to love yourself and be your own best Valentine, but it wouldn't really matter because I know you're hurting. But, you know, there's lots of support. If you need support, all you have to do is write to me at bondk@AOL.com, and I'll make sure that you're hooked up with support. You know, we'll get through this at the end of the whole holiday family mess from Thanksgiving till Valentine's Day. And then it always is like a sigh of relief for our women that they can keep walking forward. So, Alexa, I want to thank you so much for being my guest tonight. You're always a pleasure, and you're so informative. And I really do love you. You're really, truly a blessing to me, having you in my life. So thank you so much for being my guest.
Oh, and thank you for having me on. Really, thank you so much. And I love you, and I'm so happy we've been able to collaborate and work together all these years. It's been a blessing for me, too.
All right. Thank you so much. That's all our listeners. Have a wonderful week, and I'll talk to you soon. Good night. Good night, Alexa. I love you.
Good night. Love you, too.
Bye-bye.